Hello and welcome to the London Philharmonic Orchestra's September podcast. I'm Edward Seckerson and I'm looking forward to your company each month as I speak to conductors, soloists and members of the orchestra about this season's concerts, tours, education projects and recordings. Don't forget that the orchestra's website is a great place to go for further information or to buy tickets or CDs. www.lpo.org.uk. Well, as is fitting for this, the first podcast of the season, we've given over almost its entire duration to Vladimir Yurovsky, the orchestra's principal conductor. Vladimir is starting his third year in the post following two highly successful seasons in which his daring programming and enormously thought-provoking and exciting performances have reinforced the LPO's status, if ever there was any doubt, as world-class. We'll be hearing from him about his new CD release on the LPO label of Tchaikovsky's first and sixth symphonies, as well as hearing his thoughts on Mahler's monumental second symphony. But we start with an overview of the concerts that are on offer at the Royal Festival Hall from now until next summer.
How do you begin to put together the season of your concerts at South Bank Centre's Royal Festival Hall?
Well, this is a tricky one because, as you know, I'm not planning the entire programme of this season. Tim Walker, our chief executive, does the bigger chunk of work, but it always starts, obviously, with the principal conductor's programmes, and those I tend to sketch and develop completely on my own. Then I bring to him my propositions and then we discuss together what could be developed around some of those ideas and which other people, which other conductors, which other soloists could be part of it. But I always like having one major theme running through the season, even if it does not necessarily involve all of our concerts. Some of our concerts, such as the run-out concerts in Brighton and Eastbourne or Birmingham, or the children's or family concerts, have their own agendas, and we have to respect those. But last year, we have put in the center of everybody's attention our revealing Tchaikovsky series. This coming season, it's going to be the world of Alfred Schnittke. And I've always stressed that it's important for me to seeing the things in context. So when we were doing Tchaikovsky, we have tried to put Tchaikovsky in the context of the gallery of his contemporaries, but also of the people who preceded and followed him. The same is going to happen with Alfred Schnittke, whose music is going to be appearing next to music by Haydn, Wagner, but also Berg, Webern, or Stravinsky and Shostakovich. So this is a whole world we are trying to present, at least in a sketched form, to our listeners. And this chunk of work, this festival, is for me the main part of the season. Other things coming this season, like for instance the Sibelius series with Osmar Wanske, this is something which runs in parallel, and I find it's also one of the most important happenings of the season. And then we're trying to have at least one opera in concert performances. And this year it's going to be Shostakovich's unfinished opera, The Gamblers. You can see last season and this season our programs feature quite a lot of Russian music, which I have dutifully avoided in my very first season with the orchestra because I didn't want to be cliched. Just as, you know, a Russian conductor who does only Russian music. But now I think I've shown to our audiences all the other interest which occupy my mind, and all the other pieces which I wanted to present, non-Russian pieces. Now we're going back to the to my personal roots, but it inevitably involves musics of other countries. So, for instance, apart from the already mentioned Schnittke series, we'll also have a concert dedicated to the Czech music of the turn of the centuries, with the pieces by Suk and Janáček. And also in one of the January programs, we juxtapose Shostakovich's Fourth Symphony with Szymanowski's Violin Concerto. Almost an unlikely combination. But we're trying to keep the scope of our work as wide as possible, and keep the music in the programs from the 18th until the 21st century.
The first concert of the new season at the South Bank Centre's Royal Festival Hall is on the 25th of September and contains just one work, Mahler's Second Symphony, Resurrection, a huge work requiring huge forces, including two soloists and choir in the final movement's dramatic evocation of Judgment Day, replete with offstage bands and two mighty earthquakes of percussion. Unusually for the orchestra, they will be repeating the work on the following evening, so that's two chances not to miss out. Last season, Vladimir conducted the orchestra in Mahler's First Symphony, and Alison Atkinson, the LPO's digital projects manager, asked him if this really was the start of a complete cycle.
Well, first of all, I'd like to mention briefly that I personally do not view this programming of Mahler symphonies as my personal cycle, for the simple reason that all of the symphonies I'm doing here, I'm doing for the first time in my life. And it is to do with my maybe rather strange belief that one should perform symphonies, especially for the first time in one's life, in the order as they were written, because to me the 9.5 symphonies which Mahler left us, probably we should say then 10.5, because Das Lied von der Erde should be counted as a symphony, present a meta cycle. So there are like 9 or 10 movements of one gigantic symphony. This is how I see it, and that's why my very first work, which I did with the LPO, was Mahler's Opus 1, Das Klagende Lied, the plaintive song. That was the opening of my first season. In my second season, we have performed the first symphony, and what's also very important, the first sketch of the first movement of the Resurrection Symphony, Die Totenfeier, which is an indispensable part of Mahler's journey towards what we know as the Second Symphony. And now there comes the Resurrection Symphony itself. For me, it is one of the few works which made me wish become a conductor years and years ago. I think I was around about 16 when I heard it for the first time, and not live, was on an old LP record, and it completely changed my life. It was not the first symphony by Mahler I heard. The first symphony which I heard was number 5, but probably I only understood half of it, because I was completely unprepared. The second symphony, it's much more accessible it's a much earlier work, and the language of it is much more colored by all sorts of the aspects of German Austrian Romanticism, although it is already a work aspiring to the aesthetics of the 20th century. But it is still very much a piece which belongs into the era of late Brahms, Wagner, Bruckner, and all the world around the German Romanticism. But it was also very important for me to put it into some kind of a context which would relate the work to us, to our times, and that's why in the second of the two concerts, the Saturday concert, we will precede the symphony by one of the most important works of the late 20th century, a very brief but an immensely profound work by Georgi Kurtág called Stelle, which is dedicated basically to the same questions as Mahler's symphony. What's the point of human life? What is death? What's beyond death? And although the work, as I said, is very brief, it's only 12 minutes, I think it gives a wonderfully compact and yet incredibly profound introduction to the world of Mahler's Second Symphony, besides the fact that both works start with the same tone, G.
And Mahler's Second Symphony makes use of vocal soloists, soprano and mezzo-soprano, and a choir, and it's a five-movement symphony. What does it do to a symphony to bring soloists into a genre that's not traditionally thought of as having soloists?
For some people, it's the most problematic area of the European history of music. It started with the late Beethoven. It started with Beethoven introducing vocal soloists into his Ninth Symphony. And a lot of people followed into Beethoven's footsteps. Liszt is one example with his Faust Symphony. And then, of course, the whole development of the Wagnerian music drama later in the 19th century deeply roots in this last final movement of the Beethoven Ninth. So what Mahler does here, Mahler writes his own first version of I wouldn't call it a remake of Beethoven Nine. It would diminish the universality of this symphony, but there is a very, very close relationship between these two. I think what it makes, it opens other possibilities of expression, and it certainly obliterates the classical boundaries of a symphonic genre. The Second Symphony is not his first attempt, because we shouldn't discard Das Klagende Lied, which was probably the very first and probably the boldest attempt of Mahler in this genre. But the Second Symphony is this strange animal, which is neither a symphony nor an opera, but it is just a fantastic piece of music.
Reviews Roundup. The orchestra's summer residency at Glyndebourne Festival Opera is in its final weeks. One of the season's eagerly anticipated highlights was Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, which Vladimir conducted for the first time in the Opera House. Sue Berling, the orchestra's cor anglais player, gives us a glimpse of what playing at Glyndebourne is really like and rounds up some of the critical reaction.
Hello, I'm Sue Berling and I'm the cor anglais player with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and I've been a member here now for about 13 years. We're coming to the final weeks now of a long 4-month stint down at Glyndebourne, which is a real privilege for the orchestra. Fantastic place to be and marvellous work for us, and some really fantastic opera performances. Tristan, particularly with our principal conductor Vladimir Yurovsky, is an epic work. The curtain goes up at 3:30 and comes down sometime after 9:30. Tristan is very, very special. And this is Vladimir's first run of Tristan's, although the orchestra now has done, well, this will be our fourth run. Previously, 2003 down at Glyndebourne, 2007, and we did four performances out in Baden-Baden. And 2 years later, here we are again with a new conductor and a revived show. It really is quite special. I'm sitting here the morning after feeling a little bit shattered. It's hard work and demands immense concentration from every single player in the pit. Tristan, for me particularly, for any budding cor anglais players out there or those in the know, it is quite a large part for the cor. It's hard work, as I've said before, for everybody. The first two acts are long and intense. But come the third act, the cor anglais player has to sneak off and is heard with this ethereal, plaintive chant out to the sea, while Tristan is hoping for his love, Isolde, to return. But on this particular occasion now, I've been put up into the lighting rig, way up into the ceiling of Glyndebourne Opera House, in order to play this. I'm up there on my own in a little dark corner, very hot actually, being in the lighting rig, for about an hour, and it's quite a lonely little time. But then after all that, I have to sneak back down into the pit, which is actually the tricky part. I have to do a bit of a limbo underneath the second trumpet's music stand in order to get back in, and I got all hitched up the other night. My skirt got caught in the music stand, and it was so much merriment trying to get me in without being noticed for the remaining part of the last act. Looking back, we see where we've come from all our rehearsals at Henry Wood Hall to now the last few performances. For me, the rehearsals are actually the best part, I have to say. That's when you feel the full force of the orchestra and the most amazing sound coming from these singers. That's when we really hear what's really happening. The slightly frustrating part for us, sitting in the pit, is that we're under a big shelf. Effectively, we're under the stage. So we're a long way down and we're a long way under, and we don't hear that. Once the performances start, we really don't have much contact with the singers. We can't hear them terribly well. We can't see. And so you do feel a little bit detached. So musically, it's an interesting dilemma. We are totally reliant on our conductor. And so if he's smiling, we're having a good time. And if he's grimacing, well, we know things aren't going so well. We have had some lovely reviews. Jeff Brown in the Times says here, he views it as a love story, and the London Philharmonic Orchestra obliged with a range of dark burnished colours that would make any interior decorator proud. Well, that's the only other thing I love doing, so that made me laugh. Oh, it's fantastic reading some of these, actually. I'm just looking here. Andrew Clements in The Guardian. Vladimir Yurovsky, keeping the London Philharmonic carefully in check. It worked beautifully, if with some loss of physical impact. Now, he's commenting on that very fact, that it's an enormous orchestra, and when we're allowed to let rip, we really do. But this is where Vladimir comes in. He has to really keep us down very often in order to let the singers through. As I was saying earlier, that Tristan is a monumental work with incredibly different colours, different nuances and details. And Richard Fairman in the Financial Times comments on the attention to detail and scrupulous balance that Yurovsky and his orchestra invariably achieve these days were expected. But by the final act, he had gone further, igniting a blistering intensity that threatened to send Glyndebourne's elegant wooden interior up in flames. With music making such as this coming out of the pit, nothing is beyond Glyndebourne at the moment. That's very special and very nice to hear. Critics and reviews are, of course, really important, and they make or break soloist careers. But as I said, at the end of the day, when the baton comes down and the lights fade and we get the feedback from the audience, I have to say that's what really matters to us.
Newsflash. In mid-August, the LPO were the first UK orchestra to launch an application for iPhone. Free to download, it's a great way of keeping up to date with the concert calendar, news and blogs from the orchestra, for previewing new CD releases and making sure you're alerted about new editions of our podcasts. If you have or know someone with an iPhone or iPod Touch, do suggest to them that they have a look. And if you like it, please give us a good rating on the iTunes App Store to help spread the word. New recordings. There are two new CDs out this September on the LPO label. First is an intriguing recording from the orchestra's archives, a 1949 proms concert conducted by Sir Adrian Boult, celebrating the 70th birthday of John Ireland. Not such a well-known name now, Ireland was extremely popular in the first half of the 20th century for his very particular brand of English Impressionism. Included here is Ireland's Piano Concerto, a terrific piece performed by the Australian pianist Eileen Joyce. This CD has already been flagged up as Classical CD of the Week by Geoffrey Norris in the Daily Telegraph for its tingle of nostalgia. The second release is conducted by Vladimir Yurovsky, a two-CD set of Tchaikovsky's first and last numbered symphonies, Winter Daydreams and the seminal Pathétique, both recorded live during the 2008 Revealing Tchaikovsky Festival. At the heart of these poetic and highly strung performances is that overriding sense of Tchaikovsky the classicist, rejoicing in music's past while nervously anticipating its future. Let's hear from Vladimir Yurovsky himself about what for him was special about these performances.
Well, in case of number six, this is a product of not just one period of rehearsals and not even of several performances prior to this date. It's the result of three entire years of uninterrupted work between the orchestra and myself on this particular symphony. I lost count of how many times we've played it together. All I know is that the first time we did it was at the closure of the Royal Festival Hall in May 2005. And since that time we did it, 20, 30 times together, if not more. And this particular performance was given in the Royal Festival Hall at the end of a very, very long German tour, where we've played the symphony, I think, in 10 out of 12 concerts in 2 weeks. What I am especially proud of in this particular recording is that it's not me conducting the orchestra in a very personal and particular interpretation of the work. It's the orchestra delivering this interpretation as though it were their own. So by now they've internalized my view of the symphony so much and enriched it obviously by their personal relationship with this work and their participation, that it sounds, at least it sounded to me when I listened back to it, as though performed by one multi-headed person rather than by an orchestra. And the Symphony No. 1, this is one of the most visionary symphonies by Tchaikovsky. It's still one of the least performed among his six. Maybe not the least performed, but among the least performed. And to me, this is a work of a pure genius. Because if somebody can write music of this quality at 26, then you're not surprised that a work like the Pathétique comes out at the end of their artistic life. But at the same time, it's a very youthful work, and I hope the listeners will notice a very, very different approach to sound in the Symphony No. 1, which sounds rougher and less romantic. It's still more along the lines of the late classical tradition, and at the same time anticipating some of the Stravinsky's neoclassicism. And then you have the Sixth Symphony, which is the darkest late romanticism, already heading for Malirian paroxysm of expressionism. And both paired on one CD and performed, I think, with less than a month difference in time.